I have a guest. And this is an interesting guest, partly because I've been trying to get this guest on the show for probably about 3 or 4 years. I first met him locally at a restaurant. He's a doctor. And now he's actually a more active part of our community by working with the seniors at the Hudson Library Senior Center. I'm talking about Paul Spector. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Tom.
So I guess you're here partly to talk about your program at the Senior Center, but also to give us an idea of who you are and what makes you qualified to do that. Oh, by the way, I should also mention the other way we know each other is for a brief while, Paul and I were fellow CrossFitters.
Correct.
We miss you there. We miss you there.
Yeah. Good stuff. Good stuff.
Yeah, there you go. What do you think we should do? Should we talk a little about you first and then explain the program, or should we?
Sure.
Okay. So you're a doctor. What kind of doctor are you?
Well,
let's tell your narrative how you got to this stage.
Yeah. So, you know, I went to Columbia University Medical School, and I was always fascinated by the body and just amazed at its wisdom and how it worked. And first did general surgery internship, and then actually went into psychiatry. And the reason I left traditional medicine is because I realized that I was really interested in health, and medicine was all about disease. And the problem now, as I see it, is that there's a sick care system and not a health care system. We have, you know, a good idea what disease is, but you can't define health by the absence of disease, and it's just a sort of impoverished notion. And so I started getting more and more into the preventive stuff, and that's really what I dedicate all my time to now. I mean, doing the balance and strength thing with the seniors over at the library in Hudson is just one of the things. I really enjoy that. It's great. But I also do a lot of work with people just trying to help them create prevention programs. And
that's a business you run now, right?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
And the idea, it's not quite the concierge model, but it is a sort of a health prevention version of that, so
right,
to speak.
Right.
And you want to explain what the concierge model is, or?
Well, it's not so much concierge, as you say, but it's really basically trying to help people define where they are, where they want to go, what trajectory are they on, what is, you know, the traditional medical world telling them. And, you know, I think that you have to have some idea about health as a function. You know, what do you want health for? Health as its own thing is, you know, so abstract, I don't think it motivates people. But as you know, most of the disease now is a cultural problem. It's not a medical problem, really. It's a question of how we live. And the way I look at things generally is trying to tie things into our history as a species, you know, evolution, our genome. And, you know, the problem is really this disparity of two timelines. You have, you know, genetic change and you have environmental change. And we're basically an animal with a not significantly changed genome living on a planet that might as well be, you know, Mars compared to what we evolved in and the way we're living. And so, ironically, I think that the problem is we don't have enough stress of the right kind in our life. And that's really
So the paleo model is good. If we were out there worrying about where we got our meat tonight, that would be a good thing.
I think that is. It's not bad. Yeah. Right. I mean, it's a good piece of it.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
You know, but there's been some really interesting research now that just backs up this idea about, you know, if we stress ourselves in ways that we have traditionally been stressed. You know,
for example,
movement, temperature. Is, I think, huge. You know, we basically live in a very narrow zone.
Right, we keep ourselves pretty much within a 10 degree range.
If that, yeah.
From our house to our car to our business,
exactly.
Whatever, and really just adapt to what's out there.
And that's not good.
Yeah.
And they've shown now that the reason saunas, for instance, or cold plunges, you know, is good is because it releases these heat shock proteins that just zip up your resilience. You know, your immune system, it slows aging. It, you know, makes cancer much less likely because of the immune boost. It's just all around focus. It's those sorts of things where I think, you know, if you want some kind of measure of, you know, is this craze that's going on make any sense? You know, because every year I think people are so confused. You know,
absolutely.
Last year's panacea, it's a poison this year.
Right.
So how do you, I think if you look at the evolution story and kind of what we're adapted for, that's a good place to start.
So your program then is sort of holistic, but in an even larger sense. I mean, it's not just about the whole individual. It's about the individual and placed in history, in the history of society and culture and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's also an environmental thing in the sense that, you know, I was talking about the environment changing so much that we live in, but it's like an ecosystem too, right? And there's an internal ecosystem, there's an external ecosystem, and we're beginning to really appreciate the internal ecosystem in terms of the microbiome and all the bacteria mm-hmm. that live inside of us and how, depending upon how you live, in other words, activity levels, diet, stress, that changes the bacterial populations.
Right.
And that changes everything about your health.
And it's amazing how that just seems to have popped up. I mean, to the amateur, you know, general person of general interest, that seems to have just popped up out of nowhere. And yet it's really taken hold and it seems to be so right. And like, how did the medical profession ignore that all these years? Like, just to take one example. I heard that, for example, that there's evidence that children that are born through cesarean don't get the contact
That's
with
right.
the kind of bacteria that they need to
That's
develop
right.
their immune system.
That's correct.
Now, why did it take doctors so long to figure that out?
Well, you know, it's a great question, and I think that question is behind an awful lot of the troubles we're having, and I think it's because medicine is focused on disease.
Mm-hmm.
As I was saying, you know, they know very little about health. They don't know what makes us strong or healthy or resilient, but they do know how to identify when it's broken
mm-hmm.
and trying to fix it. And so appreciating this internal bacterial population that changes everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for instance, until recently, you know, calorie in, calorie out, right? That was the mantra.
Right.
Absolutely wrong, right? Part of the reason it's wrong is because of different bacterial populations, because what we eat doesn't dictate what we absorb. The bacteria contribute to breaking it down, how it diffuses through the gut wall, you know, how
mm-hmm.
fast it moves through the gut, a million different things.
Yeah.
So it protects us from infection. It prevents other bacterial populations. So it's a good question, but I think medicine's only beginning to try to understand the other side of
mm-hmm.
the coin in terms of health rather than disease.
You think there is a real effort in the medical community, so to speak, to start addressing these kind of things, or is it an upward battle?
It is an upward battle. I think there is a movement for sure,
yeah.
But it's like you know, a U-turn in an aircraft carrier. I mean, it takes a long time, and part of the reason, you know, you grow up.
And the funding, I mean, just the financial aspect.
Yeah.
I mean, how does
yeah.
a doctor get paid these
yeah.
days? It's not for preventive
no.
measures.
I mean, if you look at television ads, or if you, yeah, you can tell a lot about a culture if you go to a pharmacy, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at the amount of real estate dedicated to, you know, shelf space dedicated to different things. In the United States, it seems like it's just normal. It's normal to have GI problems, to have, you know, upset stomach,
yeah.
or to be constipated, or to have diarrhea, or to be bloated. I mean, there's aisle after aisle, you know, of product. So the system's been set up that you go to the doctor, you have this problem, he gives you a medication. That's not the answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of medical miracles, we're being joined. Ellen has arrived. Wait a second.
Oh, I get.
Oh, fantastic.
Stop already. Enough
Thank
with the clapping.
You.
Hi, Ellen. Ellen
Through
Thurston
the
is in the house.
The snow and the sleet.
Ellen's in the house.
I came here.
Well, Ellen.
Who, like the postman?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry I'm late. I was trying to get through a lot of ice and snow in my driveway.
It's nasty.
Well, as you know,
and
have you met Paul before? This is
yes.
Paul Spector.
Yes.
We're talking with Paul Spector, a sort of doctor who's pursuing a sort of a new model of preventive health care. Is that what you'd call it, preventive health care?
Yeah, prevention.
Prevention.
Yeah.
And who also is leading a class at the hospital, at the senior center in the hospital.
No. In the library.
Oh, in the library.
I'm sorry. I'm getting all my.
Well, it's to keep them out of the hospital.
It's logical to have a preventive medicine thing in the hospital. That would be a good thing.
But they don't.
In fact, many of the people. Maybe I shouldn't say this on the air.
Oh,
but
go ahead, Ellen.
I think people know it.
What do you got to lose?
Many of the employees at the hospital really overweight.
Not only overweight, but here's the thing. When I had my 1 week stay there last year, some of the healthcare workers would come in, and I was, you know, I had all that weird stuff going on. I was nauseous as hell. I had bloated from the bile and all. They would come in stinking of cigarettes. And you know what that smells like when you're. When you're not eating real food, yeah. It's like, how could, you know what I mean? It's just like, what a model that is.
Well, they're probably representative of the general population.
Right.
You know, I think that, you know, ironically, despite all the medical advances, we're probably at a low point in terms of general health. I mean, if you look at the number of people that are obese in the population, more than 50% of cancer is preventable by lifestyle changes. Mm-hmm. I mean, medicine isn't the answer. But the problem is, all you have to do is change everything. You know, it's one of those situations. I mean, it's funny because you grow up, and you know, as a child, I think you believe that the culture is set up for our biology. Mm. So you know, someone tells you this is breakfast food, or you have three meals a day, or you and you think, well, this must be defined by how we are made, and you realize it's not. It has nothing to do. In fact, it has to do with factories and industry and profits and. You know, what you can market. And unfortunately, it seems as if that has so defined what happens that we've sacrificed our health for it.
So your business side, how do you structure it so that it's feasible in terms of being a preventive care person?
Well, you know, I think that when you compare preventing something from happening, you know, the cost of preventing a heart attack is very small. The beautiful thing about a lot of prevention is it's a change in lifestyle, like walking. It's like eating more green. It's things that your grandmother mm-hmm. might have told you. Mm-hmm. And then there's other things that I think are, you know, more complicated. I think there are also problems in terms of in medicine, you know, the doctors are so pressed for time and have to see so many people that what they do is, you know, you have your lab work done traditionally before you see the doctor. You come in, he or she scans the abnormal column. There's nothing in it. You're good to go. Tom, see you next year. And then it's as if you become diabetic, you know, Tuesday, and you were fine Monday. Mm-hmm. When nobody would buy a stock that way. I mean, nobody would be interested in a company if they didn't have a history of how it did. So I think if you look at lab work that way, so that's one mm-hmm. of the things I do too. I say, well, let's look at this over years. And there's a trend. Let's not wait till it's in the abnormal column. Let's not wait till you're sick. Let's do something now.
So is the intake session a far more extensive kind of encounter than it normally would be with most doctors?
Oh, yeah. I like to know everything. I like to know about your sleep. I like to know about the environment which you work in. I like to know about the exhaust system in your home. I like to know about everything.
Well, that struck a note with
family history.
Yes. Ellen, what's that all about?
I was just going to say, I have Ellen. A hot air assist. It keeps falling down.
Yeah, well, maybe you have to hold it.
Sorry. yes, Dr. Tom.
Thank you.
I have a hot air system, which means that there's air blowing out of the furnace. Lord knows what it's bringing with it. I mean, there are all kinds of, I think, filters and whatever. And I live in a converted barn, it was converted in the 30s long ago. But I don't know if there are filters on the furnace to capture this stuff. There, I know of one filter, but I don't think one filter is enough. Plus, then I got two cats. My two cats, among other things, like to sleep on the bed, even before I'm in it. And I don't mind their being on the bed when I'm in the bed because they keep me warm.
Sure. Yeah.
And so. I think it's time I had the ducks cleaned, as they say.
Yeah. You know, it's something that's becoming also a new that feel we're understanding that's that house is
and it's way
live.
Beyond just
yeah.
health.
Yeah.
You know, most workers now are thought workers, right? It's cognitive load that they're dealing with. It's not factory work. You know, they're not physical workers, and actually, right up at Albany Rensselaer, there's a laboratory where they've done phenomenal work. They have a building that they can control the internal environment. Remarkably, they can change temperature, humidity, rate of ventilation, all these sorts of things. And what they did was they created, I think it was three or four conditions. One is green. One is just passing certification. One is green certified. And one they called super green. And they showed, they gave these people motor and cognitive tests, and they showed that if you just doubled the ventilation from the green condition to the super green, so if you took the green, which is supposed to be the greatest, and you just did nothing but double the ventilation, the cognitive testing scores surged dramatically. I'm talking about, you know, more than 25 points on 100. I mean, so we're just beginning to appreciate.
Or you could go live outside.
Depending upon where you live. Right?
Yeah, depending on where you live. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it is so funny because, you know, the trend at one point about preserving energy was to tighten up houses.
Exactly.
And now we're realizing that's a bad idea.
Yeah, that's right? Exactly right. It all started in the 70s. The whole goal was to seal it, as you say.
To keep energy costs down.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't a bad motive.
No,
just
understandable.
The wrong idea.
Yeah. But there's also really interesting stuff that's come out of NASA. And, you know, looking at the space station where, you know, ventilation's a problem. And, you know, you have off-gassing with all of these, you know, fabrics and materials. And people were getting sick. Actually, there's a guy who did amazing research who was an environmental scientist who was called in by the Army because during the Vietnam War, there were a lot of bases where Agent Orange was leaking. And it was causing all manner of problems, you can imagine. And one of the upshots of his investigation was he found plants that detoxify some of the most poisonous things that you can have in your home that are even better than a filter. I mean, you want the ventilation obviously going, but we've learned a lot and we're continuing to. But there's things you can do, and that's the sort of thing I do, which isn't, I mean, most doctors probably don't know what plants you have in your house, and I can't blame them. They have other things they have to be on top of.
It's not a course in medical school.
Yeah.
Healthy plants for your home.
What is Regina's specialty going to be?
Well, she's not sure, but she's doing an internship in family medicine right now.
Because she was at one time interested in working
with elderly.
Yeah, the elderly.
Geriatrics, as it's called.
Yeah. Well, I think that's another problem with medicine in the West is that, you know, we like to dissect things. And if we've learned anything, we've learned that, you know, what's good for old people is good for young people, is good for little ones. And they're all best if they're in a mix. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, education traditionally tested for your weakness, isolated those who were below, you know, scores on these tests, and kept them in a separate population. And it wasn't any good for anyone. That's another thing that's similar about medicine and education. I think, you know, they start from the deficit. They start from the weak. Can you imagine starting a relationship by saying, so what's wrong with you? What's broken? You know, what's flawed? What's imperfect?
Yeah.
What a great way to start an alliance. It doesn't work, right? So I like to try to look at what are you good at? What do you love doing? Who are you at your best? Because if I don't know that, or whoever's working, you know, how do you have a goal? How do you know what's important to the person, what the values are, what they need their health for? That's the question that I think this system doesn't have any room for yet.
Well, suppose we're at a cocktail party and people find out you're a doctor. What is the question they obviously come at you with?
Well, you know, there's usually two. You know, one is some disaster story, right, of just the most terrible you know, thing.
Yeah.
Or I have a friend who, you know, no, but, you know.
Let me break 1 second and let our listeners know. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, ICRA, Hudson, Catskill, or WGXC.org on the internet.
This is the Thursday Afternoon Show with Thomas DiPietro and Ellen Thurston and our guest, Dr. Paul Spector.
There you go. Sorry, Paul, didn't mean to interrupt
you. No problem at all. I think in the cocktail party scenario, I try not to emphasize that I'm a doctor or that I have medical training because it's obviously helpful in my understanding things that are going on. But most of the things that I have to offer people, it's really like a coach. It's like a health coach, or it's a friend who has some information that he wants to share with you that he thinks could be quite beneficial. That's sort of where I'm coming from.
Are you still writing for HuffPost?
Yeah, yeah.
So you have a regular column on these kinds of issues,
yep.
Right? Is there a special way of accessing? Just go to HuffPost?
If you just Google Paul Spector, MD, Huffington Post,
okay.
You'll get
cool.
It. Yeah. I've just done a whole series on the environmental
stuff, cool.
Actually. So.
Oh.
I have this problem in my elbow. No, I'm kidding.
I do have a problem with my elbow. Anyway. All right. I have a question for you, Doctor.
Yeah.
There seems to be some controversy over how much water you should drink in a day.
Yeah.
You know, if they tell me I have to drink 8 glasses of water, I think, oh, my God, I've got a long way to go then.
Yeah.
To get to that point.
Right.
And I read something recently about why you're supposed to drink water. It does this for you and that for you, and it seems to have a lot of, if it's good water, there we go. There's another aspect.
Yeah.
But
it's a great question. It's a great issue. And I think it's great because you'd be stunned at, you know, how many things are sort of just accepted, you know, these are facts.
Right.
And then you go and try and search for the research, the
that
literature
actually supports it.
That proved this is the answer.
Yeah.
And it's not there. And it make if you think about it, to suggest that there would be a dose for everyone in every climate with every activity level, it's
every
absurd.
Size level, yeah, every gender, everything.
It makes no sense, right?
Right.
So anybody who tells you with definity, you know, this is the number of glasses of water you should drink, period, I wouldn't listen to them.
Well, here's another question that sort of comes out of that. As you pointed out, you know, you hear all these, you get these little articles saying New York Times science section saying do this, do that. On the other hand, everybody's become skeptical of these stories. You know, there's a lot of people who just follow them blindly. But then there's also people who are just, there's nothing you can rely on.
Right.
I mean, doesn't that create a sort of skepticism that makes people sort of say, well, I'm not going to do anything then? You know what I mean? It's just like.
Yeah, it can be used to justify all sorts of things. Well, but I think it's good to be skeptical. But, you know, like a lot of things in life, I think if you want to get some good information, you have to work. And I don't think the public, and this is one of the things I do with my clients, I like to help them know how to take care of themselves. The point isn't for them to come to me for the rest of their lives. So part of that is how do you assess a New York Times science section story?
Or WebMD and all those other things.
Yeah. I mean, what, and, you know, it's not.
Or Dr. Oz.
Yeah, I mean, peddling some. Anyhow, but yeah, you know, it's not rocket science. It's, you know, there is, you know, just a handful of things that you want to see in terms of, for instance, who was it in a peer-reviewed journal?
Mm-hmm.
Who financed the study? How large was the study? Was it statistically, and you don't have to know the statistics, but it will be stated, you know, was it sufficient numbers to be able to say anything about this? Was the finding related to what they set out to do in the study? You know, and if you look at about 5-6 of those things, you can begin to say, well, this is interesting. If it's one study also, I don't think anyone should change their behavior on the basis of one study.
Yeah, that's what always upsets me about some of these little Times articles. They're just like a report on one new study. It's like, well, what's the context of that study? What were the previous studies? You know, what, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, science reporting, as I'm sure you know better, far better than we do, that is really inadequate that way. I mean, it's kind of just looking for a sexy headline.
Right.
You know,
right.
Wine is great for you.
Right.
Wine is bad for you. Chocolate is the news. You know.
Right. You know, there's not going to be a headline. Man feels better after walking every day. You know, this just in.
Yeah.
Breaking news. you know, so there's a lot of data, I think, to act on, but it's not very sexy. You know, and then there's this newer stuff that I think has to do with the stress that we were talking about, which, you know, the scientific word for it is hormesis. And it's an emerging field that I think is going to be tremendously powerful, equal to the microbiome stuff.
Who's pursuing that? Microbiologists or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Physiologists, microbiologists. Yeah.
Did you talk about stress before I came?
We did, but we can talk some more about it. Paul was saying how, you know, understanding stress factors, not so much how they hurt us, but how we need certain types of stress that we do, we've kind of ignored in our modern lives.
Yeah, we have too much of the wrong kinds of stress and not enough of the right kinds.
What's the right kind?
Well, the right kind is, you know, why is exercise good for you? It's a stressor.
Oh, it's, I see.
You know, why is changing like a sauna and a cold plunge good for you? It's a stressor. Why is a lot of plant food good for you? In many ways, it's a stressor. That's become complicated, actually, because we've done to the plants what we've done to ourselves. I mean, the plants were, you know, these black belts in defense. You know, it's an organism that can't move, that has to do with pests, you know, radiation, too dry, too wet, all sorts of things in a stationary. And so it had all of these amazing this armamentarium of defenses. And to a large extent, when we ate it, we got those defenses. But when you take the plant and protect it from everything, if you have industrially grown, and this is why, you know, the stuff that grows in your garden is so much better for you, actually, in terms of these things, you know, that are stressors. I mean, that many of them are things that cause maybe a little bit of inflammation, but that the overall reaction is to increase your antioxidants and your anti-inflammatories that the body makes itself, rather than thinking I'm going to get it by taking a supplement or something, which doesn't generally work very
so well. This whole, I mean, it's well in the public narrative, the public debate, right, discussion right now, inflammatory, anti-inflammatory.
Inflammation's huge. That's a big part of my this. Focus. Inflammation is the first chapter in basically every bad story about your health, whether it's joint disease, whether it's autoimmune, whether it's cardiovascular, aging.
So you've got all those things, including the aging.
To be alive is to have, right? But there's a lot of things that we can do that are anti-inflammatory, and some of them are the stressors that I was talking about, like temperature. Fantastic for lowering the inflammatory state. Movement, very good anti-inflammatory, probably one of the best, you know. The thing is, we're so geared as a society now to taking a medication that we lose sight of sometimes what the cause of the problem was. I mean, if you look at, it's sort of curious that you can have an economic system that's being bankrupted by healthcare costs. And yet it's still because of, I don't know, free enterprise or what, that, you know, that you can have cigarettes be legal or, you know, have all sorts of foods that we know are basically killing people.
And then we have to pick up the cost.
And then we pay for it.
Yeah.
And also it's, you know, pennies per calorie or whatever. You know, the cheapest food is the worst for you.
Right.
And then you have these food deserts where, you know, you have these areas where people be hard pressed to find a green, you know, vegetable or something. So the system's not.
And I always like to talk about this article I once read by Michael Pollan, how the reason healthy foods are more expensive is because that's probably closer to what the real price of food would be, given, you know, proper wages, all the other variables. Whereas the junk food you get, you know, mass produced,
industrial
product at minimum wage and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And subsidized often by the government.
Yeah, it's stunning. It's stunning.
So what would you hand out at Halloween if it weren't for that bad stuff?
Oh, that'd be a killjoy.
Well, you could hand out anything that's good, you know.
Yeah. Dental raisins. Floss.
Apples.
Dental floss.
Yeah, penicillin. <don't know>. But, you know, sugar, it's funny you say that because it makes you think of candy. You know, I don't know, it was in the 1930s or something, some researcher wrote a book called The Other White Poison, and he was referring to sugar and cocaine. And he was considered a total nut. And he's been vindicated. I mean, sugar, we're just not made to be consuming sugar. And our capacity to differentiate one thing's sweetness level from another is unbelievable, because that's how we survived, right? The thing that was sweeter had more calories. You could store some fat. You'd make it through. You're going to survive. So it's one of those things where we're wired for sugar. Mm-hmm. It's like an opiate. We have a pleasure response that's tremendous. It's not a mystery. But the thing is, we're not made. Our genome's not made to have a dose of refined sugar piling in. And they're showing now that, for instance, the high normal blood sugar levels in laboratory work, before anybody would say you're diabetic, are associated with changes in the brain that can be documented with imaging studies in areas that have to do with memory. And it's appearing as if a huge part of this epidemic of dementia that we're having at younger and younger ages, so that it's not a question of, you know, people are just living longer, is because of the sugar levels. And I guarantee you that whether it's 5 years from now or 10 years from now, it'll be the same as what they did with the cholesterol level. They're going to push it down. Mm. The high normal is going to be eliminated because it's associated with disease.
Mm. I'm trying to think how much sugar I ate today.
Refined sugar?
Well, I ate a chocolate cookie. Ooh. Probably had refined sugar in it.
Well, you have to have some pleasure, yeah. too. Think, you know, you...
But
how much cocaine did you snort?
I no? didn't have oh. any in the house at
oh,
all.
Okay. Oh, bummer, man.
And that this was stressful. It was stressful.
Yeah, no, I can imagine.
So that was a good thing, maybe.
Yeah. Oh,
I mean, is there good inflammation and bad inflammation?
Yeah, there's inflammation that doesn't override the system. If you think mm-hmm. about what we're made for in terms of stress response, it's episodic. It's something that has an acute phase and it's over. It's being in danger,
like,
and getting away.
Driving on a icy pavement.
Yeah, and then getting out of the car and it's over. But the stress that we experience now is usually just ongoing, low-grade, and that's what we have. We have chronic, low-grade inflammation, mm-hmm. and that is what causes a lot of the diseases that we're dealing with. And we're getting more sophisticated about measuring inflammation. But still, I mean, I work with lots of people who, you know, have terrific doctors, and the doctors just don't have time to mm-hmm. pursue some of these things. And, you know, it's much more interesting sometimes to know what someone's inflammatory level is than what their cholesterol level is. The cholesterol story is interesting, complicated, but interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, the extent to which the public's been fed different stories and how they change. I mean, the problem was fat, right? And then, oops, it's not fat, actually, it's carbohydrate, you know. And the answer to the fat problem created in large part the epidemic of obesity. it's a complicated story.
So let's, while we still have time before the top of the hour, talk about the program you're running at the library.
Right. No, I love this. It's a range of people and a range of function. You know, there's people probably in their 60s and there's people in 90. We work helping them move better, improve their balance, which is predicated on all sorts of things, but in large part practice, and also on core strength, which is something that we do exercises for. I'm a big believer in functional fitness. You know, I don't think that muscle training is particularly helpful. I think that movement training is. You know, you see people in the gym doing all sorts of things, sitting in a machine and doing. And I think it's can be counterproductive, because the normal chain of events in the, you know, motor system that are supposed to happen, like the core firing first and then the extremities firing so that your back is braced and all, doesn't happen in these machines. And so you rehearse that over and over again. And then sure enough, you know, their back goes out because that's what their body's been trained to do.
That's funny you mention that, because, you know, there are a lot of things I can't do at CrossFit, being 61, approaching 62. And I always blame my extremity strength, particularly my arms. I mean, I know you can do incredible pull-ups. I have a hard time doing them. And yet, but I've been developing my core, and you know, that's what they focus on. And I keep thinking, well, isn't that better that I'm working on that?
Absolutely.
Rather than, you know, doing those curls that get your arms all beefed up.
Yeah, definitely.
Because you know, I never even understood what you just said, that the core makes everything else kind of, what did you say, fire or whatever?
Well, if you think about it, in order to be able to exert a force through your extremities, whether you're running and it's through your legs or you're pushing or pulling something with your arms, it only can be effective if you can brace the torso. If that's not stabilized, you know, you'll exert a force and the whole body will move, right? You're not going to move the object, you're going to move the body. That's what the core does. So it's interesting. You can see people who say they're doing core exercise and they're moving all over the place. And you have to wonder, you know, the core, they're stabilizers. So you can put stress on the stabilizers by moving the extremities. But if your midsection is moving, I don't think you're doing core. That's not, doesn't make any sense to me. But that's where strength is. And if you look at, you know, construction workers, they may not look so fit. Or, you know, they used to have hockey teams, professional hockey teams would play farm guys. And they'd beat them all the time. But the farm guys were way stronger. And they go, how is this possible? The professional athletes are pushing around in the gyms. I mean, 400 pounds, you know, on these sleds and things like that. And the reason is because the farm guys moved whole body movements through every plane, in every, you know, dimension, and that creates strength. You don't create strength. You get good at what you do. So, you know, you get very good at doing that exercise in the gym, but thinking that's going to translate to the real world, you know, I don't think it's going to work very well.
So what kind of things do you just balance? Now, except balance isn't really so much, is it exerting strength, or how does core work in the balance situation?
Right. So core is really what helps you, first of all, be aligned, which is critical in terms of balance because, I mean, you know, if you've ever done diving or gymnastics or anything, the body follows where the head goes. And as we age, most of us have our head go forward, you know, we get some of that slump. And what that does is it throws our center of gravity off. And so that not only causes, you know, tightness and pain in the traps in the neck.
Maybe that's why I was so bad in the balance.
But there's corrective exercises for that, right? That that bring the head back, that are tremendously helpful for balance because that's where you want the head's the heaviest, densest, right? That's where you want it to be. So that's one thing. And then when you lose your balance, the thing that pulls you back is core. It's that central strength. And there are things that we do that basically rehearse being in positions where you're in and out of balance that are tremendously helpful for that.
So the core is your torso, your back?
Yeah, it's basically 360 degrees around the middle of your body. You know, there's some debate. Some people would say this is a part of it, this isn't. But it's really that midsection that stabilizes, you know, the lumbar spine, abdominals, you know, all around there, glutes.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that has to be a six-pack, right? I mean, or does it?
What do you mean, six-pack?
Well, you know, that rippled effect that you see, like...
You don't need to see anything. You know, they're guys...
It's more internal thing, right?
It's like, you know, people say, how do you get that, right? Yeah. You know, and it's table pushaways. Have you heard of that?
No.
Yeah, it's eat less. You
know, it's... table pushaway. You thought it was going to be...
Yeah, but I mean, if it's visible, it's not because they're necessarily so strong or developed. It's that there's not a lot of fat in front of it, so you can see it. But it's not an indication, really, of strength or fitness.
Well, back to sugar
for a second. Okay.
So the sugar that's in fruit, for example, natural sugar, unprocessed sugar.
Yeah.
Isn't it? I mean, honey, I'm told, is processed sugar because the bees do something with it. It makes honey. But is that as bad for you or is it not bad at all?
Well, you know, there are gradations for sure. And anybody who says a piece of fruit is just as bad as a candy bar, I think is wrong. But Fruit, you say, is a natural product. The problem is it's not anymore. You know, if you're on a walk and you pick some berries and eat them, I mean, they're tart beyond belief, right, compared to what we get in the supermarket.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there's the difference between the sugar content, fructose, and, you know, what you know, get in the woods, very different. So to call it a natural product and therefore it's okay, you know, is probably not clear thinking. But it's also, what is it housed in? So a fruit is going to give you something that has a lot of fiber in it also. So juice is not good because it's usually, there's no fiber. Also, all the satiety, the sense of being full, doesn't work very well with liquids. So juice is not a good thing.
And if it's if it's juice you buy in the supermarket, it has added sugar and various things.
Yeah, yeah. I am actually advocate not so much fruit, unless it's coming off a tree in your backyard. You know, it's more wild. Yeah.
So, just to provide some information, what days do you do your program at the library for seniors?
Saturdays,
yeah, from
1:30 to 2:30.
1:30 to 2:30 every Saturday.
It's working out that way, pretty much. Yeah,
and I heard it's oversubscribed.
Yeah, yeah. They're great. You know,
like 40 people.
Not in one class, but we need to get more classes going. I'd like to do all sorts of things. I'd like to. Do a falling class, for instance, where you know you
learn how to fall properly.
Which is really there's some research going on now that is just amazing. Working with, you know, where people are in these they're suspended sort of, you know, so that they can't fall, and you have them on a treadmill and they abruptly stop or accelerate the treadmill, and within a few sessions the motor patterns develop, and they see how long it takes to extinguish before they lose. And people have gone 6 months without any further training and not lost. So there's all sorts of things that are becoming, we're getting better at being more efficient and more successful with that kind of training.
And that's because, as we know, a fall can be devastating to an older person. And that's part of the natural, what do we call it, the degradation of a human being. I mean, things do degrade. I mean,
but that's another big story, I think, is you know, what we have come to accept as a model of aging, and what is actually pathology due to the way we're living. And you know, Tom, I mean, you do CrossFit, fantastic. You know, 10 years ago, somebody who was 60 years old, it would be quite surprising to see them doing the things that you do in CrossFit, right?
Yeah.
We haven't changed genetically, right? We're changing the way we're living.
Right.
When I reached a certain age, it seemed...
and we're not going to ask what that was or is.
It seemed that my body changed a lot in a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And where I had muscles, not, you know, fantastic muscles, but I had something that one could call muscle, was suddenly gone. And it was just skin... and bones just sort of hanging there. Yeah.
There's a lot of reasons for that, though, and that is not something that you just have to accept.
Right.
So one thing that has been documented...
Is it too late for me,
Not
doctor?
At all. That's what I'm trying to say. You know, first of all, we don't absorb protein nearly as well as we age.
Mm.
So the recommendations that are on the books are way low.
We for need how way much more, protein?
For how much protein. It's closer to something like 1.6 grams per kilogram. And we could talk about what that would mean for you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. The other thing is they've shown that they can take 80-year-olds, 90-year-olds, put them on a strength and conditioning program, and they build muscle.
Yeah.
It's not something that stops being possible. The other thing is, I don't know if you're familiar with, there was a study called Counterclockwise.
No.
You have to look at this. It was brilliant. Counterclockwise.
Wise. Okay.
And what this woman, I think she's out of Yale, brilliant, did was take a group of people who were, I think, in their 80s to this retreat. And that they said, let's play at this game. We're going to act as if you're 25 years old. And everything there... every magazine, you turn on the radio, it's going to be a radio show or a game from the, you know, There's going to be a picture of you when you were 25 on your door. And they did testing before and after, motor, cognitive. You would not believe the change in test results with no medical, no exercise program. No,
no intervention at all.
Nothing except, I mean, so there's so many things that can be harnessed that powerfully change things. We are conditioned to believe that, you know, if we're 80, it's done.
So it's not so, it's not just vanity when I look in the mirror and say, hey, you look 25 years old.
That's a good, you want that. It's good for you.
That's maybe I know. Should have saved those old clothes that I wore.
But it's it's never too late.
Right.
And I love working with the folks over at the library because I find them quite, I don't know how to say, I think they're quite a bit tougher than a lot of the younger people that I've worked with. Huh. I've never had one of them say, I'm not going to try that. Right. Or that's ridiculous. Or I would look foolish.
That's a generational thing too, right? I mean, let's face it. I can now say it as a 61-year-old. Younger people are spoiled. They don't know what it was like in my day. I had to walk 5 miles to school through snow and rain.
Right.
It's, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
So what do I say to my cardiologist when he says, avoid stress?
Avoid stress. Well...
Yeah, good for you to say.
What kind of stress? You know, so we could, let's talk a little bit maybe about bad stress.
He and I don't talk about stress, except I'll complain about, oh, I have to do this, and I'm over, you know, I took on too much. And
Right.
So it's like going to a psychiatrist, I guess, and letting it all fall out.
That's good. I mean, did you feel better when you leave?
I don't, maybe. But I mean, it is hard to avoid.
Right,
that,
so there's no avoiding
stress.
Right. But yeah. There are things that we can do, and now there's good science. I mean, you know, people have been doing yoga and breathing for thousands of years, and Western medicine just discovered it. But we have good data now on, for instance, inflammatory markers when you do yoga kind of breathing daily. What happens? There's all this research around something called heart rate variability, which is sort of interbeat changes. You know, the heart's not a metronome, and it speeds up and slows down the time between beats always. And you want a lot of that. And one sign of...
Oh, I'm told that's bad.
No.
I mean, I have an irregular heartbeat.
Oh, that's
so
different. Yeah,
oh, okay.
That's different.
All right.
But what I'm saying is I think there are things that we can do that are quite easy, that cost nothing, that have no side effects, you know, that you need no equipment for, that can dramatically reduce those bad stressors, their impact on your biology.
That sounds good, doesn't it?
Well, I'm thinking you're coming with me to CrossFit tomorrow.
Ah.
We're going to get you started.
I don't think so.
Why, you have no gym clothes?
I don't. No, I have never exercised in a gym. I've never gone to, I guess I'm afraid of what other people will see that I can't do.
Well, you don't need to go to a gym.
I've been in dance classes, maybe.
Dance is one of the greatest things.
I tried to do Tai Chi once and it made me dizzy.
Yeah.
Amazingly. Amazingly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I got breathless. I mean, just walking around a room, but so, of course, I never came back to the class. There you go. But
it's funny you mentioned dancing because, you know, they've actually done studies now because they look at all the different types of activity. And dancing comes out on top every time. And they think it's because, first of all, it's social. It's you're learning new motor patterns. It's something that people... It gives them pleasure. I think that you want to try and find something, whatever you're going to be doing in terms of exercise or health plans, that you enjoy. Because if you don't, you're not going to get as much out of it.
Right.
And you might not even get what
you hope
out of it.
You might not even show up.
Yeah, well, you're not likely to do it, are you?
Uh-uh.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, we're at the top of the hour in a couple minutes, and we got to identify ourselves, Ellen. Who are you? I just forgot.
He's having years. Problems.
It's that dementia again.
This is the Thursday afternoon show, it being Thursday.
I'm Tom DiPietro, and that voice was Ellen Thurston. We're talking to Dr. Paul Spector, or just Paul Spector, who, among other things, is running a program at the Hudson Library on Saturdays at 1:30. If you want to, I guess you can go over, even if you can't get into class, you could sign up there.
Yeah.
Or call the library. Is there? Can they call the library as well? Call the library, ask for Brenda Schufelt, yep. I think would.
It's a city program, which is the library is cooperating with the city on, I think. Okay. It's a city project.
Okay. Well, then I'll take credit for it because I'm, you know, in government now.
Right.
Tom is the president.
Anyway, cool. Thanks for coming in, Paul.
Thank you.
We have
it was
to
great.
Play the news in a couple minutes. Mm-hmm. What else can we say? You can read Paul Spector regularly on the Huffington Post, where he writes about all these issues. Have you ever thought of compiling them into a book?
I have.
And?
I haven't gotten to it.
Do you know Atul Gawande, Dr. Gawande?
Yes, sure.
His books are so accessible to people.
Terrific writer.
Yeah. And I'm sure he would love talking to you somehow.
I would love talking to him.
I envision it.